Today on Maine Calling, Maine's affordable housing crisis. If ever your Economics 101 class were to come in handy, it might be for this: understanding Maine's housing mess. The Maine State Housing Authority estimates that 25,000 new affordable homes are needed to meet demand. Not surprisingly, the problem is particularly difficult in southern Maine. Greater Portland's population has grown by more than 40,000 in the last decade, but only 12,000 new homes have been built during that time period. Across the state, there's an enormous demand for housing, but a very low supply. The result? Crazy prices and unaffordable rents. It's a problem not just for frustrated buyers, but for employers and workers, and for those just trying to keep a roof over their head. So what's to be done? That's what we'll discuss today with some experts on the front lines. Maine Calling is coming up next.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at WelchForbes.com. By Maine Seacoast Mission, strengthening Maine's coastal and island communities through education, health, and support. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Anyone who's recently looked at buying a home or renting an apartment in Maine knows just how tight the housing market is and has been for the past few years. And it doesn't matter if you're looking in Cumberland County or Aroostook County, affordable housing is hard to come by. Today we're going to hear about some of the efforts underway to alleviate the problem and some of the challenges that are standing in the way. My guests are Sonia Trous, Executive Director of Yes in My Backyard, a San Francisco housing group; Shannon Richards is Vice President of MERIDA, the Maine Real Estate Development Association, and the founder of the real estate firm Hayrunner; and Dan Stevenson is Westbrook's Economic Development Director. We invite you to join the conversation. How would you solve Maine's affordable housing shortfall? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Shannon Richards, let's start with you. This is one of those puzzles that's easier to describe than it is to solve, but let's describe it going back a few years to the height of the pandemic. We saw this influx of people coming in from other states. As we remember, some were planning to retire here, but maybe were prompted to do it a little early. Some always wanted to live here, but were tied to their jobs, and now they could work remotely. So they said, "Oh, that's great. Let's go to Maine." Some were just fleeing this frightening virus in the urban communities that they were living in. I'm sure there are other groups. But in they came, and suddenly there were these sight unseen purchases, bidding wars, homes going for $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 over asking, and then soaring rents. Is that the genesis of what we're experiencing now, or is there something else going on?
Well, that's great. That's a great summary. I think you're talking about both like what got us here and some of the results of and where we are right now in your summary. I think to answer your question, you're right. And also there is more. And that's what we're going to talk more about today. I would say that Dan and Sonia, who are both here today with me, have a lot of perspective and have been in this for a long time. In Dan's case, really long time. No offense, Dan. I think it's a result of the pandemic for sure. I think it's also the generational changes we're going through. There was a deficit of housing in terms of new housing being produced over decades. So we're coming to its a head based on a lot of different factors.
If you go back 10 years, I think we cited this at the top of the program, there were some 40,000 people moving to Greater Portland in the last decade since 2010, but fewer than 12,000 homes. Mm-hmm. So the math just doesn't, you're pointing to the math just doesn't work there. Something's got to give. And in this case, it's price. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And so, but, and let's bring it to today. There had been a bit of a cooling off this spring in terms of the real estate market, as I read. But where are we now?
Well, I think we're seeing inflation. There's some corrections happening at a Fed level, and the interest rates are coming up to try to cool inflation. So when interest rates go up, the amount an individual who's relying on a mortgage can afford goes down. So that's going to cool housing prices and costs. I think there's been a little bit of like, when you've been running a sprint for a long time, how do you then go back to a jog? Your perspective is skewed, you know, your muscles are tired. So right now, everybody's looking over their shoulders and looking around the room, you know, are we jogging or am I still going too fast? You're trying to catch your breath a bit.
There's also this other phenomenon that's affecting the supply of houses that are on the market, which is that while the values have gone up, which is great for sellers, there's nowhere to go if you sell. And as you pointed out, if you have to finance, interest rates are up. So people are hanging on to their homes. That means there are fewer houses on the market. So they're kind of stuck. There's nowhere to go. There's no liquidity, I guess, in the market. Is that also what's part of what's new?
Yeah, absolutely. We are in a housing deficit. And so if you go to sell your house, where are you moving is a big question. So you are going to not potentially list your house. And unless you're planning to move away, and even then, you know, it's a bit of a chicken and the egg.
So Dan, there's the problem described. Feel free to add to it if you'd like. But how do we, and by we, I mean people like you, in Westbrook, sort of loosen the grip, I guess, that this is having on real people, you know, at the street level. You're economic development director, but affordable housing is front and center, I'm sure, for you. And I can remember a time when, you know, Portland was so expensive that everybody fled to Westbrook to find a place to live. Those days, I'm guessing, are over. It's no longer a sweet haven of affordability. What's happening in Westbrook?
Well, Keith, first, thanks of all for being on the program. A couple of things. I want to go back just one step backwards. When we look at housing at the local level, we're street level practitioners. We look at all housing in the community. So the first question, you were talking more about single family home sales. Part of what's exacerbating that is that we're the oldest state in the nation. And people that are my age and older that are willing to downsize are now buying up the homes, the smaller homes that first-time home buyers would go into. So that actually makes it worse, and there's no inventory. That's part of the problem. I'll now focus more towards the affordability piece. I think it's important for people listening today to understand what is affordable housing and what is workforce housing. You'll hear terms like 120% area median income or AMI, 80% AMI. You'll hear things, low-income housing tax credits, or we call them LIHTC, 60%, 50%. So for people listening in, you're going to hear us talk generally in the time frame we have about affordable housing. So in Westbrook, although we look at all housing, we still need market rate housing. But the crisis is more towards affordable housing. And a lot of that is in the rental market right now, right? So just in a nutshell, what we do is four quick things we do. First one is we identify the needs locally and regionally. What's really happening in the city of Westbrook? Who do we find that out with? Our partners, Maine Housing, Westbrook Housing, Avesta, LIHTC developers. And they're saying, here are the changes we need in order to build housing. Two, we need to align our land use regulations that match those needs so we can get them constructed. Three, to the best of our ability, reduce the time frame in order to get units constructed. Quite frankly, it used to be soup to nuts. The day you shake someone's hand to the day it's built, 3 years. Well, sometimes it's upwards of 5 years. That's really not fast enough. We need to do things that make it happen faster. But something that doesn't get discussed a lot that I think we need to have a lot more discussion around is financing in the capital stacks in order to build affordable housing.
Okay, so a lot going on there. The state has stepped in and tried to help with the from a statewide perspective on LD 2003 to help communities like Westbrook get at this problem through looser zoning, a whole host of other issues. But I know I'll just say I know that you're not a big supporter of a statewide solution.
And the reason is Maine is a large rural state. And if you were to travel to northern Maine, say Fort Kent, or you'd travel to eastern Maine, say Machias, that one standard, that one size fits all, is just not applicable. Communities have comprehensive plans. And with the difficulty, we only took in an issue with just a few pieces to it. The 2.5 times multiplier, that should be done locally because it doesn't always work. And the second thing is towns that have comp plans, if you put brand new growth patterns on top of that mandated by the state, it doesn't always work. But there's a lot of good stuff in there, too. And I wanted to make that point. That is, the idea that affordable housing is being tackled at the state level is important. But we also believe locally and regionally we can get it done. And at some point during the show, I want to let you know specifically how we've tackled it in Westbrook and how we drove our driving affordable housing in our growth area downtown, access to transportation, and when I have an opportunity again, we'll let others speak. I'll explain exactly what we've done and what the results are.
Okay, and we will definitely come back to that. I want to bring in Sonia here, Sonia Trauss, who is executive director of Yes in My Backyard, based in San Francisco, and she is a keynote at today's MERIDA conference on affordable housing that's taking place. Sonia, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yes in My Backyard, we are based in San Francisco, but it's actually a national organization. Our political partner, Yimby Action, we have 43 chapters in 19 states.
And I did note that, I looked at the map of where those were, and I didn't see any in New England, and I wondered whether that's just a coincidence that there are other entities there, or whether that's because New England is a bastion of NIMBYism.
No, I don't know. We're waiting. I feel like there's one in Portland, you know, almost ready to surface.
Okay.
So we've actually been surprised. We have a lot in the South and in the Southeast, of course, California. What we've seen is chapters forming in places where, you know, prices are going up quickly. And these are places where Americans have been moving, right? I mean, Arizona has been growing very quickly. There's we have an Arizona chapter. The Southeast also, people from all over the country have been moving there. I don't know. I mean, there's a New York group, but they're not one of our chapters because they're one of the older groups. We're looking forward to more New England chapters.
So explain what YIMBY, we know what NIMBYism is, but what YIMBY is?
Yeah, so the idea, you know, instead of not in my backyard, it's yes in my backyard. And to Dan's point, you know, I started organizing people to be pro-housing in their own communities, but also in neighboring communities. You know, one of the things that was sort of novel about what we were doing was that we were crossing municipal boundaries to say, yes, you know, we need housing. I was living in Oakland, but a lot of Oakland's housing shortage is really caused in San Francisco. And I mean, we see nationally, right? I mean, there are people in Austin who are like, California, you know, you're causing our housing shortage. So the thing about housing shortage, and at the beginning of this program, right, you referenced that a decade ago, people would leave Portland to go to Westbrook. And when prices were rising in Westbrook, it was actually because of housing decisions made in Portland. So that's one of the reasons why states wind up getting involved, because cities will say, oh, we made our comprehensive plan for our interests. But a lot of times cities will say, we don't really, or towns or neighborhoods, you know, will say, we don't want to build more housing, right? We're sure the next neighborhood over will do it. And then you have a tragedy of the commons where every single community is like, we have something special here. It's so cute. It's so lovely. a 5-story apartment building is going to be completely different. And so it's going to ruin everything. So someone else do it, someone else do it, someone else do it. Then nobody does it. So that's why the state, you know, we've had local control for 100 years, really. So states have to get involved now to be like, okay, guys, you know, nobody did it. So now everybody has to do a little bit. But, you know, in the absence of that, right, when we were first starting, you know, and the state in California, for instance, hadn't passed all these new laws, or, you know, here you only have, you have this one recent big reform, individuals can still get involved and say, yes, you know, we need housing for specific housing developments. So there's a sort of a structural, you know, change that can happen, but also people can take advantage of the existing structures to advocate for housing. So that's what we do.
Yeah. So at the end, as you're pointing out, there's this sort of, there can be, you know, this resistance, even if there is willingness of the planners and everything to loosen up zoning in an urban spot or in a neighborhood, the neighborhood people who are established there will say, oh, they'll use phrases like, oh, well, we need to preserve the character,
right,
of as a main for maintaining the status quo. And you would advocate for them abandoning that kind of vague term and maybe be more specific about what exactly they're trying to preserve, you know, like tree
yes,
cover.
Yes, the term neighborhood character. I mean, I think, you know, YIMBYs, where, you know, we have chapters, we operate, actually, like, the narrative change is happening. I think a few years ago, people could just go around saying, oh, neighborhood character, we need it. And now it is becoming a little bit embarrassing because it's totally vapid, right? If you have something that you like, maybe you like the tree canopy, say that you like the tree canopy. You know, you have something else you like, you say, oh, we always have bay windows, or we never have bay windows, right? You can say that. Say what it is you want exactly. You want a nice mix of retail. You know, you want a lot of small stores. Okay, these are all things. If you're resorting to neighborhood character, then either you have no idea what you want. You know, all you want is the status quo. You're speaking purely from feelings. You're saying things that cannot be the basis for public policy because they're 100% amorphous. Or what you mean is something racist and you don't want to say it out loud. Or something classist, right? If you're saying neighborhood character because you know that it's too out there to say this is mostly, you know, a rich neighborhood, this is mostly a white neighborhood, and I want to keep it that way, then, you know, obviously, like, it's just a dog whistle. Yeah. Don't say that.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you, your questions and comments. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today, we're talking about affordable housing. Joining me, Shannon Richards, Merida Vice President and founder of Hayrunner, a real estate firm, Dan Stevenson, Westbrook's Economic Development Director, and Sonia Trouse, Executive Director of Yes in My Backyard, a San Francisco-based housing group that's a national group. Share your comments and questions. Email at talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or on Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. Dan, you mentioned during the first segment there that you had a list of specifics that, in this case, Westbrook was doing to address this problem. Now's a good time to probably get into some of those.
Sure. Yeah, I'd first like to say, though, one of the concerns when the state gets involved is sometimes advocacy can be misplaced. And there are many opportunists out there. There's slates of housing bills up in the state right now. And there's a lot of us that are street level practitioners that do that, that are doing the good work of the people. So I just want to be able to state that as well.
Explain an example of someone taking advantage of a well-intended law?
Sure. Well, I'll give you an example. We actually belong to Grow Smart Maine. We think they do great work. Right now, there's a slate of 16 bills up there. Most of them are all addressing very specific, very detailed components of Maine housing, which have different effects on different community, and it dives deep into standards. So what I'm saying is a lot of them have great concepts in there. a lot of them could be applicable locally and regionally. We just feel locally we want to be part of the discussion and we want to continue to do so. That's really it. So it's not that it's the state taking a proactive approach, I think we all appreciate, because remember, one of the things I talked about is financing. It's not just about land use regulation and people being participating. So how do you finance these deals and get it done? At the end of the day, identify the problem, work with your partners and solve it. So so what do we do in Westbrook, right? We were getting a lot of pressure, right? Portland's growing. That is correct. All of greater Portland is growing, right? So we sat down and talked to affordable housing developers. One of our biggest partners is Westbrook Housing Authority. Right. And other partners would other what we call LIHTC developers would come and say, here's the problem. We can't get the density we need in your downtown. So without any state support, the city went ahead and we took a very dense overlay district that's in what we call our urban core or our heart. Now, I'll be honest, Maine is a rural state. Even Portland is a small city. Westbrook's a little over 20,000 people. But we do have a vibrant downtown. So what we did is we took those standards and we did an overlay district to the entire downtown. What are those standards that would help facilitate getting more affordable housing in our community? The first thing we did is density. That's an issue. Can you get more units on a smaller lot? And so what we said is for every 500 square feet, you can have a unit. That gives ample amount of density in your downtown. The second thing we did is we reduced unit size to say, look, you can have 400 square feet. State statute is 190 square feet. What I argue is go look at 190 square feet and live in it, and then we'll have a conversation. 400 square feet is pretty small, and it's still livable. And then the other thing we did in parking is we said one space per unit. However, it's still negotiable. The one thing when there's the market will just control the parking, I struggle with it in rural communities, because if you don't have access to other modes of transportation, it's very difficult. So what we do is, let's say you have senior housing, let's say you're adjacent to a commercial lot that may be overparked and it shouldn't be. Can you put some parking there if you're on Metro line? So the private sector is part of the solution. They come in and say, hey, what we want is, 0.67 space per unit, because now we have enough parking to market. But at the same time, we have enough parking that will realistically work. In some areas of the city of Westbrook, even with on-street parking, there's not enough room to handle the units. And in practice, when they're built, if there's not enough parking, they don't go to the local legislator. They don't go to their regional government. They go to the city and say, how come you didn't provide us ample parking? What we're saying, you shouldn't overpark. What we're saying is it's negotiated in the city of Westbrook, and it's worked exceedingly well. So what has happened since we've changed that a few years ago? We have a total of 283 units online to go up. We have six housing projects total in this area. And 63% of them, of the housing units coming on the market, meet 120% AMI or less. So remember, we still want market rate housing in our downtown, because through a municipal lens, I have to look at the entire city. Like we have to have balanced tax base as well. We want mixed income in our downtown, because mixed income really helps for healthier communities. We look at the fabric of the community. But just by making that change, deals were being able to be penciled. And that's where it comes in, how these are actually financed. And my presentation today, for those listening, if you can still make it over, sign up and go to the spring conference that Marita's putting on, because there's a lot of great speakers, including Sanja's the keynote, and I'm excited to see her as well. But my presentation will really talk about that, and I have images and photos of what's happening. So really at the street level, we're dealing with it in Westbrook, and we're dealing with it successfully.
Okay, let's go now to Marty Grohman. He's a Biddeford City Councilor and co-chair of the Biddeford Affordable Housing Task Force. Marty, are you there?
I sure am, Keith. Thank you.
Yeah, so tell us about the housing market in Biddeford. What's going on there in the downtown?
So the market in Biddeford is really strong. We have about 1,600 residential units under construction or pending. And if people want to live here, it's a gritty mill town with a fine dining problem.
Right, which is not a bad place to be. I'm wondering if, as you mentioned, it's been a working class kind of industrial mill town its entire life, which is kind of in its DNA. Does that mean there's less resistance maybe to some of these ideas of higher density, looser zoning, and less about, you know, the preserving character forces that might be more prevalent in a tonier town? I don't mean to disparage it, but I'm just wondering if it's not the same as Portland, right?
I think that Tonya's right. There's a tension there still, Keith. I mean, I think you're asking a good question, but we do have to do some of these things to get this right. We want to increase the percentage of affordable housing that gets built. Something that's really interesting is that our affordability index as a technical measure in Biddeford has actually been improving, and that's because higher income people have been moving in. It's also because we have been getting some affordable housing projects built. But the school department is telling us, look, when we recruit teachers out of the University of Maine at Farmington, they're coming back and saying, we are finding stuff that fits in Biddeford for our needs. So we do have work to do, and it's always that tension of retaining that community feel while getting these new projects built.
And you've tied new building permits to affordability. In other words, there are restrictions on building permits unless the project includes some sort of affordable element. Can you tell me kind of how that works?
Yeah, this is a first for us. So the council just put this in place about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and it's giving us a couple of meeting cycles to really get this right. We want to work on everything from parking, road frontage. We're lucky in that our comprehensive plan is coming out at this same time. So Dan mentioned some tensions between those two things, but we're able to have those both happen at once. And we really want to get this policy right so that we get more affordable units, we keep this pipeline of units going, but we don't force development outside of Biddeford. We want people to come here and build. So that's sort of a magic tension point. I'm sure that will be dug into at the Merida conference extensively today.
Yeah, does Biddeford have any specific housing goals?
Yes, we do. We are looking to create 90 units of affordable rental units. That's defined at the 80% median income level for each of the next 5 years. So that is a lofty goal, and that's really what the council's pushing to achieve.
All right, Marty Grohman, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Shannon,
from a realtor's perspective here, real estate perspective, how do you've heard from the kind of urban planners and the economic development folks here. How do you see it through your filter? Are these effective ways to sort of inject some affordability to make the market more liquid for people of different income levels? Or do you see other ways of doing it? Is it just a simple question of building more, for example?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I can't look at it just as a realtor. I am a realtor, but I also am a mom. I live in Portland. I live in an urban community. I look at it as a community member. I own a company that does design and construction. I think at the end of the day, it's a mixture of needs. I think we need to get aligned. I think we need to be sophisticated at the way that we examine this issue. And I think that we do need more housing at the end of the day. We need more of it, and we need it of all different kinds, shapes, and sizes. There's lots of different people, lots of different levels. And I think we're going to talk more about that today.
And Sonia,
yeah,
I want to talk
about affordability is that two things. One, in conversations like this or in public policy, there's a lot of emphasis on new housing, but really, hold on, guys. It's live radio. Anything can happen.
You've got a little one with you just to explain.
You know, in any given town, how much of your housing stock is new, right? 1%, less than 1%, 3%, if you're really growing. So most housing is existing housing. And so most people, when they're shopping for housing, mostly are looking at housing that's already been built 10 years ago, 150 years ago. and most people live in existing housing. And most low-income people live in market-rate housing, right? So if we price-controlled housing, inclusionary density bonus, you know, purpose-built subsidized housing are extremely important. We have it, we need it, we probably need a lot more. But for people who are working, you know, for workforce housing, you earn a wage. If we're thinking that we're gonna provide housing that's affordable just through public programs, that's the wrong direction. Somebody who's working, even if it's working at Target, you should still be able to go onto the market and shop just like anybody else, not have to apply for a specialized program and fill out a lot of paperwork. You know, you should still be able to find something that is market rate that you can afford. And the way to make sure that existing housing in affordable communities doesn't get expensive is to make sure that there's plenty of new housing being built as demand increases, because otherwise higher income people are going to be bidding up, you know, these formerly expensive places. And, you know, it is interesting. It's worth looking into. I'm glad that public officials are listening to the show and participating. Who moves into new housing? You know, and thinking about where did they move from? So, you know, you might build 90 new units or 150 new units, but you're actually creating more vacancy than just those new units, because probably 80% or more of the people who move in already lived in the community. So they're moving out of somewhere, and that might be the kind of place that's actually the market rate is cheaper. So you're creating, you know, even more affordability than is obvious, that meets the eye.
And to Sonia's point, this is Dan, and to Sonia's point, that's a good point, right? That when you have an abundance of housing, right, that helps stabilize the market. I want to bring up another point, though, right, is that you have to finance these deals. And that, so when it comes to inclusionary zoning, the only way I support it, the only way I support it, or rent restricted, is if there's tax credits in the deal or if there's cash in the deal to buy down the capital cost. You can't subsidize rents without buying down the capital cost of the project. It's simply a fact. They have to be financed. But if you overbuild a bit and anticipate that, I think Sonia's correct. That helps stabilize the market.
Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Paul, who is calling from Topsom. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, everybody. I'm calling because I am the CEO of a nonprofit called 3i Housing of Maine. Our 3i's are independent living that can be achieved through innovative technology in an integrated home and community-based setting. This is a project that is taking root in Scarborough, where we have plans to develop 51 universally designed, totally accessible units for people with mobility impairments and physical disabilities. And we're at the intersection of healthcare and stable housing. We know that stable housing is a social determinant of health, and we're breaking down the bias towards institutional care, where people who need help with activities of daily living and are low income are placed, I dare say, warehoused in long-term care facilities when they could be living on their own through this 3i model.
Yeah, Paul, so how is it? How are you financed, if I may?
Well,
ask.
just like what Dan said, likely this will be a LIHTC deal. So we've been in discussions with the state, and we also, I would like to point out, you have a guest from San Francisco. One of the things that we're finding throughout the country, there are 61 million Americans who have a disability. That's one in four families. And healthcare systems are making investments so that they're not actually serving as landlords for people who are residing in hospitals or healthcare facilities after they've been discharged. And that's putting an enormous crunch on the healthcare system. So organizations like Kaiser Permanente out in California are making significant investments in supportive, stable, accessible, affordable housing. And yeah, that is something that, you know, we need to take a hard look at.
Yeah, Paul, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Thanks for joining the show. We do need to take a quick break. I'll have you comment when we come back. But I do want to give the number 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. We'll take a quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're learning about ways to address Maine's affordable housing problem. With me, Dan Stevenson, Westbrook's Economic Development Director, Sonia Trouse, Executive Director of Yes in My Backyard, and Shannon Richards, Merida Vice President and Founder of Hay Runner. Join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on social media or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. I don't know who I cut off before we were going to the break. Was it Sonia? Did you want to add something?
The housing is healthcare sort of message and philosophy. It is amazing. It is a bright spot in a lot of depressing news that health insurers have realized that and appreciated it. And one of our Southern California groups, I don't know if they got a grant from Kaiser, but they got a, you know, that type of grant to help organize support for the kind of housing that the previous caller was talking about, because, you know, it's great, right? Everybody on this call was listening to the description being like, wow, that sounds amazing. But everything has to happen somewhere, you know? And so once an actual home is proposed in a neighborhood, inevitably, not even if most of the neighborhood supports it, the people who are against it are loud about it, you know? And so, that's why it's so important. And that's why our Southern California activists got a grant to organize people who are for it, to make sure that they're not just like, oh, that sounds nice. Okay, cool. I'm going to go pick my kids up. But that they actually get that message, like, yes, I like this idea, goes from the person to the elected official, because when you don't tell your elected officials that you support something, then the naysayers speak for you, you know? And so it really is important to do that work and, you know, support organizers in your community that are helping do that work, because, you know, the money's part of it. Of course, you need money, but you need the political will, too. And that's a lot of times what's faltering.
We've been focusing on Southern Maine for obvious reasons here, but there's a lot of stuff going on around the state. And Shannon, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about some of the latest figures came out for May. And I think that some of the median prices for real estate were in double figures in other parts of the state. Franklin County was up 23%, Oxford County 19%, Somerset and Penobscot at 13%. Are we seeing any sort of quiet hot spots of real estate that we might think might otherwise be unlikely?
Yeah, I think we are. We're seeing some, I can't remember exactly. I think Skowhegan has really seen an uptick. Dan, maybe you know more about this too, but I mean, we're seeing areas of the state kind of collectively where people are seeing an opportunity, we'll say, and then you'll see more people go there. It generally has to do with some other amenity.
Sure.
Dan,
that's absolutely correct, is that, you know, again, Maine's a very large rural state, and the needs of each community and region are different, right? So if you say, like, I'm going to be up around Presque Isle, I'm going to be in lower part of the county in Houlton, or I'm going to be in Bangor, I'm going to be right in Greater Portland, we're all dealing with the same problem, and it's scalable, but there's not one solution that will fit. There's one point that I want to bring up too, that you work with your regionals. We have regional planning agencies with a lot of skill sets that can work with you for those of you who don't have professional staff, especially in these rural towns out there.
Let's go to Bridget, who's calling from Augusta. Hi, Bridget. Welcome to the program.
Hello. My name is Bridget, and I own and operate a market rate property management company. It's very small. I have about 70 clients, maybe 300 to 400 units. My mother has been in real estate in Maine for 30 years. My parents were investors when I was a child. I really kind of grew up in the trenches of tenancy. And so I currently manage 100 units in Rumford, and I'm seeing a lot of development and things changing there and the need for affordable housing there. And then the rest of my units are Oakland, Augusta, Waterville, Gardner, Central Maine, things like that. And I'm coming into this conversation with the bottom of this whole perspective. So at the end of the day, I'm sitting in the apartments with the tenants, speaking with them, saying, you know, this landlord has 10 units. He's got a big mortgage. He has very high oil costs. I need to rate increase you, and I don't shoot the messenger. This is what I get hired to do, and how can I help you? And I am a firm believer in trying to really understand these individual people. I meet with them every day. I sit at their kitchen tables. And they're like, Bridget, I just can't afford it. Where do I go? And I'm like, let me try to find you something. Let me help you with the paperwork. For a brief period in time, I did work for Realty Resources as a property manager in Central Maine, managing affordable housing complexes. And it's much different managing affordable housing tenancy than it is market rate tenancy. And I'm not talking luxury here. I'm talking very blue collar, middle of the road market rate housing. And I, yeah, the biggest struggle that I have when I'm trying to figure out, okay, how do I serve my client and get them market rate so this building can self-support, is I'm struggling with the towns and code enforcement. And they're like, Bridget, you know, life and safety code, and there's hoarding going on, and there's, you know, maybe these, and I'm rushing to get my maintenance staff and my builders there, but we have vendor shortages. Our carpenters are now costing $65 an hour. You know, stove drip pans used to be $11 or $40.
And so your costs are going up. Yeah.
So they think we're these really terrible landlords that are increasing rent, when really oil spiked $8 a gallon, and one of my clients was facing $100,000 in increased oil bills. And then I had this little French meme landlord that's owned her building for 40 years and literally lives in it. She only owns 9 units, and her oil went from $400 a month to $1,600 a month. And I'm sitting with these tenants who have substance abuse issues, criminal backgrounds, maybe they have disabilities, and they're living in market rate land, and I have no help for them. Yeah. I have a 55-year-old tenant that's a hoarder, and she has no family, and I call Adult Protective Services, and they can't help me.
So, sorry to interrupt, but managers. Yeah, you know? I get the gist here. I think you're sort of being the voice of people who might be painted as heartless capitalists, when in fact you're dealing with real human beings, and it's difficult for you. And it's from a business perspective, you're paying higher, you're facing higher prices because of inflation and the difficulties. But let me ask you, so what you've heard the sort of the discussion here today, but from where you sit, what do you think the answer is to this?
I think that we do need more affordable housing, and I think you're getting resistance from the wealthier communities with the stigma of those types of people that would be living there. You know, just say it. I've managed one in Camden. Camden's a very beautiful place, but these people are drunk and they throw trash on the ground, and they have maybe some drug history and are inviting people over that these communities don't want to see in their backyard.
Yeah, Bridget, thank you. I appreciate your input. I just need to move along, but I really appreciate your input. Sonia, this I want to just bring you in because she's sort of talking about, I think you mentioned that there are classist overtones to some of this, right? There's resistance that is sort of unspoken, but it's really people don't want people in their presence.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and you know, another thing she's talking about, I mean, look, housing is at the root of many problems, but no one thing solves everything, you know? And at YIMBY, we want to like mix incomes. We want to mix races, of course. So we want economic diversity in a community. And at the same time, you know, as a nation, we need to do something about poverty. You know, economic integration, that's all well and good, but that doesn't mean that poverty is fine. You know, like this woman who has, she's a hoarder and she has no family, right? Like, or if you have substance use problems and you're never treated, right? Like these are huge problems. And at the end of the day, I actually think they have to do with poverty, because you can have a lot of issues, but if you have a lot of resources, then you can get a lot of help. So, you know, personally, outside of YIMBY, right, like I support universal basic income, you know, and a generous welfare state. Social security, like disability and for old age should be, you know, very well adequately funded. We need distribution. I mean, there's no reason that we should have so many billionaires that are so incredibly rich. In the past, you know, our Gini index was narrower. So, yeah, I mean, housing, like we want mixed income housing. We want people to not be classist. And at the same time, we want the people who are the most desperate to actually be well-resourced.
Let's go. Let's try to take as many calls as we can to work in here. We'll go to Sarah in Topsom. Hi, Sarah. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, in my town and in my neighboring towns, I see houses that are empty or abandoned. And I was wondering if those houses were included in the housing shortage statistics. And then also, if there were any initiatives to bring those houses onto the market.
Yeah. Anybody want to grab that, Dan? Go ahead, Shannon.
I was just going to say, I think that another thing we're going to talk about today at the MRIDA conference is the fact that there is a substantial amount of housing in Maine that is just aged and you can't live in it. It's not the cost of construction to repair something. There's a tipping point where it makes sense to just honestly let it rot because you can't fix it anymore. And unfortunately, you can drive down roads and see a number of houses that have been abandoned like that.
And just to quickly add in there, it becomes a little more difficult than that when it's back taxes owned by an owner that's absent. What the city of Westbrook did is did a complete inventory, reached out to those who owned the taxes and said, look, let's try to get you caught up so you can get this, you know, rehabbed and leased up or sold in the market. And we essentially cleaned up all of our homes, except for like two. We've really done a really good job with that. One other thing when it comes to homes, and I just want to point this out because it hasn't been discussed yet, about getting more units on the market. It's kind of going to Sonia's piece about that. The tighter the market, the more expensive things are going to be, right? You got to help diversify that. They're the old ADUs or, you know, the old in-law apartments, right? Accessory dwelling units. That can be a double-edged sword. And I just want to make a comment for those listeners out there. We, even before LD 2003, we had an ADU ordinance on the books. And for those of you who wonder what that is, that's creating a space either attached, detached, or in your house that allows, has a kitchen, a bedroom. And a lot of times you'll find your parents coming back to take care of them. Or if you're my age, you could have one of your children coming back to take care of them. And that helps with some of the affordability. However, we don't regulate short-term renting. Sometimes people will say ADUs take care of affordable housing, but a lot of people will build them and then they'll Airbnb them. It's good for the homeowner to buy down the cost of housing, but just buyer beware, it doesn't necessarily take care of someone else going to the unit. But I just wanted to put a little plug in there that I think people in general are okay with them, but you got to kind of weigh what it means when you have a comprehensive ordinance on that.
Joel is writing in, John is writing, what about tiny homes? Can they help in the housing crisis? Is that sort of the same thing, Dan?
Sure. You're starting to see a lot more tiny homes come in. That's basically higher density in smaller spaces. They're just not connected by walls. I think the jury's still out over how they're going to come over the next decade or so. Remember, every time this is done, we always have to go back to how are they financed? Why aren't you seeing more condos? Because of apartment units are more easily financed, right? So I think you have to always have that as part of the equation. But right now, I think, you know, hey, if you can get more density, that makes a lot of sense. But it also...
We only have 1 minute left, and I do want to just ask a quick question about rent control, because it's on the Portland ballot, and it seems to be a perennial issue. I know we can't argue rent control in 1 minute, but we have to. Sonia, do you want to go quickly first?
You said no existential question at the end.
I know. I know. Doing this. I violated the rule.
Yeah, I mean, I would say don't get too ideological with it. You know, I think some people, rent control can like create a big reaction, you know, for or against. But it's a phrase that describes really an astonishing variety of potential public policies. So what we're really talking about, you know, is regulating the relationship, trying to create housing stability, trying to create, you know, income diversity within a community. And those are really great goals. And there are policies you can put together that advance those goals without stifling, you know, new building or encouraging people to take units off the market. Because a poorly crafted rent control policy really can, shut down new building, and it can make landlords want to just, yeah, take their apartments off the market, and that's not what anyone wants.
That's probably it's also worth
only
it.
Part of the solution. You know, yeah. You still have to build more, because if you have more people, you need more housing.
Maybe worth its own show. Sorry to end with that, but there you have it. And with that, that's the last word. Thank you all for joining us. Sonia Trauss is the executive director of Yes in My Backyard, which is based in San Francisco but has affiliates throughout the country. Shannon Richards, founder of Hay Runner and vice president of Merida, and Dan Stevenson, Westbrook's economic development director. Today's sound engineer was KG Akinmaladun. Visit MaineCalling.org to find our past shows and to subscribe to Maine Calling's weekly newsletter. Tomorrow on the program, a look back at the political and other news stories that made Maine headlines in May. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.